Do, here we go. From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'm here tonight with Fongaboo Phil and Lil, who are trying to get themselves organized here, and we will be your hosts this evening. This is episode number 35 of Little Brother for the 16th of February 2002. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. Okay, and the show is Little Brother. The topic is technology. And before we get started, I need to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the Rensselaer Student Union, or the WRPI staff and management. And participants, not necessarily those of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the Rensselaer Student Union, or the WRPI staff and management. And responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. Also, if you'd like to throw in your 2 cents worth, please feel free to do so. The number here at WRPI is area code 518-276-6248. That number again, 518-276-6248. If you don't feel like you want to put your voice on the phone, on the radio, please feel free to send an email. My email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That address again, critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop.com. And last but not least, you can always send snail mail. The snail mail address here is Little Brother, Box 31, 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180. So without further ado, let's get started. We're going to start with an item from the Risks Digest, and we're going to hand this one over to Lil.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm hogging the good story, but I saw the title, and I had to read it. It says, software bug blamed in radioactive spill. And I have to know about this. It's just in a, you know, it's in Australia, it's not here, but it says Amec Engineering, which designed the Beverley Uranium Processing Plant in Western Australia, has blamed buggy software for a radioactive spill that occurred at the site last December, confirming early suspicions that computers played a role in the accident. After a detailed assessment of the incident, it is now clear that the problem was caused by a computer programming error that has since been corrected, said Stephen Middleton, spokesman for the plant's operator, Heathgate Resources. According to Amec's reports, the glitch cut power to the plant's fluid distribution control system during a routine service exercise. At the time, the mechanism should have shut down pumps moving fluid into the plant. Before they could be shut down manually, pressure built up in the pipelines leading to the plant, and one ruptured, Middleton said. According to Middleton, Amec has re-examined the entire system, retested the plant's pipes, and corrected the computer logic error. He refused to name the software technology responsible for the error.
Okay. We did have a phone call on the line, but they hung up before we could get to them. So, of course, if you do call in and we don't pick you up straight away, of course, we would want anybody listening to call again. And keep calling till you get through, because we will get to you, hopefully. So you want to... did you want to take a look at...
Let me take that one, yeah.
There you go. Okay. Let's see. An error has been found on the tax form sent to Connecticut residents who collected unemployment compensation last year, the State Department of Labor announced on Friday. About 5,000 forms, less than 3% of the 176,000 tax forms sent, contain information pertinent to individuals other than the named unemployment compensation recipient. The article doesn't go into much more detail, but it sounds like a classic mix-and-merge problem, with the headers for the mail labels being off by one or more from the other data fields. Nothing about this on the Connecticut website as of this report. You got one that looks interesting there, Phil?
Yes.
Okay, well...
I'm not going to read it.
Oh, you're not? Okay.
Okay, you want me to read it?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. It says, turning Macs on thievery. Every year, about 400,000 computers are stolen in the United States. Only 3% are ever recovered. But after his sister's iMac was stolen during a burglary, a Houston man was able to get it back using remote control software, expert help from friends on the net, a large dose of luck, and some incredible naivete on the thief's part. In a story that is probably unique, R.D. Bridges recovered his sister's stolen iMac using Natopia's Timbuktu Pro, a program that allows computers to be remotely controlled and is widely used by computer help technicians. Bridges, who lives in Clear Lake, a suburb of Houston, had installed the software to help his sister, who lives across town, when she ran into problems. The iMac and a printer were stolen last October. Foolishly, the thief didn't erase the hard drive. When they connected to the net, Timbuktu alerted Bridges and iMac was online. Oh, the iMac was online. Horrified, his sister's resume, tax files, and other sensitive files were still on the hard drive. Bridges hoped to install a suicide script to erase everything. Using Timbuktu, he figured he could put a script into the Mac's startup folder, which would be automatically executed the next time the machine was turned on. My sister didn't want a crook going through all that stuff, Bridges said. You know what it's like. You have tax returns, letters, your resume, telephone numbers, addresses. There's so much personal and private stuff on your computer. You don't want crooks going through all that and then paying a late-night call on your in-laws to your in-laws' friends.
Okay, we have a caller on the line, so let's see who's here. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Bye.
Okay, well, so be it.
All right, so here we go. For help, Bridges turned to a Usenet news group, alt.comp.lang.applescript. AppleScript, the scripting software built into the Mac's OS, can be set up to perform all sorts of functions, including trashing files. Mark Myers, an AppleScript expert who runs AppleScriptsToGo.com, responded with a clever script that moved everything to the trash except the systems folder, emptied the trash, and shut the machine down. Myers' death script included the system folder because... Oh, excluded the system folder, because any attempt to erase it would prompt an error message, stopping the process in its tracks. Shortly after Meyer's script was posted to Usenet, Bridges was alerted that the iMac was online. He copied the script over and surreptitiously erased some of his sister's most sensitive files. Unfortunately, the stolen iMac was connected, using his sister's ISP, her login and password, which gave Bridges no identifying information about them at all. No names, phone numbers, anything. He hoped maybe the police could get an IP address or phone number from the ISP, but he later found out that the company didn't log incoming calls. Starting to doubt he would track down the stolen machine, Bridges changed the startup screen, the graphic displayed when the machine boots up, to show a Jolly Roger branded with an Apple logo and emblazoned with the stolen iMac in big yellow letters.
Oh yeah, they actually had a picture of this on the website describing this.
Well, I wish we could have seen it.
Oh, it's great. I'll have to see if I can find it and put it on the website.
I was kind of desperate at that point, he said. I couldn't figure out where it was. They were using my sister's ISP. A user on the AppleScript news group suggested writing another script to launch a pop-up reading. You have won a special $500 prize. Your machine has run for 3,000 hours without a major problem. The script would prompt for a name, address, and phone number to redeem the prize. But Bridges was skeptical. It seemed kind of ambitious and also relied too heavily on them being both gullible and honest in their answers, he wrote. Instead, he came up with the idea of a script instructing the iMac to call him or his sister. He would then get the thief's phone number from his caller ID. The advantage is it takes the human factor out of it, he wrote. I don't have to rely on their greed to get the info. At first, it appeared that the death script had worked. The machine didn't connect to the net for about a week. But unfortunately, the death script had a flaw. If any of the files in the trash were locked, it failed to empty the trash. Myers whipped up a fix, which Bridges copied to the iMac. Meanwhile, the iMac had been switched from his sister's ISP to AOL. Bridges figured this out by installing WildPackets EtherPeak, a software program that records IP packets, from which he extracted the IP address and traced it back to AOL's domain. Bridges continued to erase files one by one, but was wary of taking full control of the machine in case anyone figured out it was being remotely controlled and shut it down. Bridges also changed the AOL dial-up to his home number with his sister's number as the backup. He and his sister soon received about 15 calls from an unknown number. Bridges tried to look it up online, but it wasn't listed. His sister passed it on to the police. I think we have a winner, Bridges told the news group, which had attracted quite an audience curious to learn the outcome. Hopefully, the police can get an address from the number and get a warrant. A few days later, Bridges reported he'd talked to the investigator. He said he went to the house that belonged to the phone number that I had dialed my number. A lady there admitted she had it, but said she got it from some guy. She agreed to bring it and the printer out for him, but didn't want him poking around inside her house.
Bridges said the woman was charged with possession of stolen property and given 1 year's probation last week. "The planets lined up for us on this one," said Bridges. "It was really kind of fluky and good fortune." Tim Williams, the Timbuktu product manager at Netopia, said that in the 13 years the software has been available, this was the first time he'd heard of it being used to track down a stolen computer. "We had a pretty good laugh," he said. "It was very clever. He took exactly the right approach."
Okay. You got one, right?
Kodak backs down over website blunder. People involved in a month-long dispute with Kodak will receive digital cameras at a knockdown price following a mistake on the company's website. The Kodak EasyShare DX3700 digital camera was offered on the company's website for only £100 for a short period at the beginning of the year. As consumers rushed to buy the cheap camera, Kodak claimed the price was a mistake and should have been £329. Several hundred consumers were believed to be affected and had been threatening legal action against Kodak unless their contracts were honored. Kodak has now bowed to the pressure, saying the orders will be processed immediately. Quote, "We regret any inconvenience caused by these exceptional circumstances, and we appreciate our customers' continued patience in allowing this matter to be resolved," read a statement. "Mistakes of this kind have happened before. 3 years ago, Argos mistakenly offered television sets for £3 rather than £299. Robin Bino, a lawyer with City of London law firm Charles Russell, believes e-commerce sites will be careful with their small print in the future. Quote, "It looks like in Kodak's case, an automated response was sent to customers, and this constituted an acceptance of their £100 offer," he said. Quote, "In future, companies with any sense will have wording in the small print which would allow them to cancel an order, and they will not have an automated response that could screw that up," he added. So I'm sure this is...
Don't most companies have on their, you know, their ads, prices subject to change without notice?
Yeah, usually. But what happened in this particular case is there were confirmation emails that actually came back, and they were viewed as a binding contract.
Mm.
And that's why they were forced to stick with it on this one.
I don't think you can really argue with that.
No, you can't really. not in any way that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here's a beaut here. This is Microsoft shooting themselves in the foot. The Microsoft email newsletter MSDN Flash, Volume 6, Number 2, January 22, 2002, contains advertising text that includes the text, "Over 180 hours of content in the three technical conferences." Now, the standard Microsoft adult content filter includes a rule that the message body containing the text, "Over 18, is adult content." As a result, the MSDN Flash was rejected by Microsoft Outlook as being unwanted adult content because of the "over 180" line in there. They said, "I wonder how many Microsoft customers have successfully read this particular issue of the Flash." Let's see here. It's an old one, but a good one. AP reports that Hewlett-Packard's annual report filed on Tuesday mentions the names David and Lucite Packard Foundation, Edwin Van Pronghorns, Eleanor Hewlett Lehman, and Mary Hewlett Gaff instead of Lucille Bronckhorst Gehman and Jaffe, respectively. A spelling checker
run amok.
Got a hold of it. Spelling checkers are not qualified to run mucks.
John Stewart actually, in his book, has a whole essay where it just consists of him taking like words and phrases, common ones that the spell checker didn't recognize, and it's the hilarious replacements.
Yeah, the problem is when you have it set up to do the automatic substitution sometimes.
Yeah,
and it replaces oddball things with even odder ball things.
That's the thing exactly. Now there was a case many years ago, I would have to guess it was probably sometime around 94 or so, where somebody was attempting to send out an email on the topic of the Pentium chip. This particular email was repeatedly received by people as making reference to the Penguin chip. Now, perhaps it's a little bit prophetic as to what a lot of people actually ended up using this particular chip for and what I use it for, but... I don't think that was quite what they had in
could
mind.
Could have been replaced with a lot of worse things, you know, than Penguin.
Yeah, well, let's not go there, eh?
Gives a whole new meaning to the term fuzzy logic.
You know how, like, you know how Pentium chips? You know how Pentium chips are kind of like a gray color, and then the AMDs have the silver?
Yeah.
Well, you get a whole bunch of them and just make, like, a chessboard out of them. That would be cool.
That's something you ought to do. You're the one that's got the access to...
Yeah,
to...
but I mean, I don't see too much AMD stuff. If anyone has any dead chips, send them over to RPI.
Send them
to us.
Care of WRPI.
Yeah, we'll make the chessboard and take a picture of it and post it on the website just for the sheer hell of it. Here's a true story that illustrates several familiar risks. This one is submitted to Risks Digest by Edward Felton. He says his sister-in-law, Karen Rakov, was quite surprised recently to discover that according to a website called SlatkinFraud.com, she and her husband, Robert, had pocketed more than $5 million from a Ponzi scheme in which they were involved. All of this was false, including the part about having a husband named Robert. The accusation on the website, hyperlinked to Karen's business and to her list of clients, and it even named one of her clients, so this was a big problem. Mm. Now, a little research revealed that what had probably happened was a person named Karen Rakov was involved in some court papers, and an internet search for Karen Rakov turned up a link to a person with that name, who the SlatkinFraud.com people proceeded to accuse. Risk number one, accusing a person of a crime based only on similarity of the name to that of a real suspect. Risk number two, trusting internet searches to give semantically correct and not merely textually similar results. So, Karen asked the SlatkinFraud.com people to remove the references to her business, her clients, and from their website. They replied by saying that they had done so, but in fact they'd only removed some of the references. Karen complained again, and they replied that our assistant webmaster has made another search and believes that all of the references to you and your company have now been removed from the site. But we have over 60 megabytes of material at SlatkinFraud.com, so manual searches are not the most efficient way of doing this. Risk number three, using technology to build artifacts that are way too large for you to manage. Risk number four, making unverified modifications that you cannot easily undo. Eventually, all of the offending references were found and removed, we think. Now, here's what the really interesting part is. The webmaster of SlatkinFraud.com is a well-known computer scientist who definitely should have known better. Risk number five, thinking that risks only apply to newbies.
Risk number six, lawsuits about slander.
Yes, well, that's kind of the overshadowing risk of this whole incident.
Yeah, I think after they first tried to tell me that, oh, well, we believe that all the material's been removed, when they should know darn well that they could possibly be in legal trouble. I mean, if I had one on hand, like if I had a lawyer on staff, I'd send them a quick little note jotted down by him just to...
Saying, make sure.
Yeah, you know, just to get them really moving. You know, probably she didn't lose any business over it, but still, you know, it's not exactly ethical on their part.
Yeah, no, it isn't. Speaking of not exactly ethical, you want to run that one?
Oh, before that, I was going to chime in. I was speaking of semantical responses from search engines and spell checkers. I'll have to find the URL for you next week. But there's some satirical site that actually has a interview with Jeeves. Of AskJeeves.com.
Oh, man. I think I've seen that.
The interview consists of the guy punching the questions into Ask Jeeves and then the very non-semantical, unrelated questions that come back, and it's...
The answers have nothing to do with the question.
Actually, I'll tell you, there's a... do you know about the Ask Jeeves Easter egg?
There's a few.
The one...
Is Jeeves gay?
Is Jeeves gay? That one. Yes, that's the one.
I prefer the term jovial.
No, actually...
That's how it was at one point, I know.
Okay, when I tried it, he came back with a different response. when Phil tried it, he got the same response I had gotten. That was basically it was none of your business.
Right. That was a while ago.
Yeah, it was. So maybe they've...
Talking into the mic.
Okay.
They changed it. I remember way back when it did say... prefer the term jovial, and I believe you get some interesting responses when you put what is the airspeed of a laden swallow
Oh yeah. What is the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow? And one of the first responses that comes up is, what do you mean, an African or a European swallow?
If I can recommend a good site for that kind of stuff, eeggs.com is devoted solely to Easter eggs of all types. I even learned about the express mode on most elevators.
You're gonna have to tell me about that one.
A lot of elevators, like if you hit the door close and the floor number simultaneously, you like oust out anybody who's waiting on floors in between.
That's
your,
cool.
Your leave and departure floor.
I would try it at work, but the elevator's only got two floors there, so it would be kind of pointless. But that's a cool one. I'll have to remember that one to see if I get a chance to try that one out.
Most elevators.
It's probably a particular brand.
I make no guarantees.
Yeah, exactly.
Go look it up on eeggs.com.
But the back to Jeeves' answer about the velocity of a swallow.
Mm-hmm.
The thing of it is, the first question he comes up is actually a legitimate hit, because if you click on that one, it'll actually take you to a list of sites that discuss the Monty Python's search for the Holy Grail.
Yeah. So next up, tangling with the Business Software Alliance can mean big problems. According to Chicago outplacement firm Challenger, Gray and Christmas, nearly 2 million people were laid off in 2000. That's an awful lot of ex-employees left with time on their hands. And if they happen to feel they've been treated badly, have been privy to misdeeds by their ex-employer, and want to use this time to settle a few grudges, at least one industry organization is ready to give them a hand. The Business Software Alliance, an international anti-piracy software industry organization supported domestically by such firms as Microsoft, Macromedia, and Autodesk, collects fees of up to $150,000 for every unregistered software program installed on a company's computers. And just where does the BSA get most of its leads on whom to bust? That's right, from pissed off ex-employees. You may have heard the BSA's radio commercials on local stations lately, inviting those with information regarding potential piracy to call BSA-sponsored 888-NO-PIRACY and telling employers that, quote, unless you have no current or former unhappy employees, you're only one phone call away from a BSA investigation, which could lead a lot of companies to think something that roughly translates to yikes. No less threatening and scary is the BSA's direct mail campaign, which sends letters to businesses warning them of possible consequences should they be investigated and found to be in possession of stolen software. Quote, the BSA is clearly within its rights to send such letters, but from what I've seen, these letters are hardly warm messages from software vendors, says Electronic Frontier Foundation senior staff attorney Fred von Lohmann. Quote, they're more like thinly veiled threats. Even if a company is honest and has no stolen software, receiving such a letter can cause both stress and monetary losses as the company attempts to chase down software purchase information. The BSA, however, stands behind its actions, emphasizing that companies with nothing to hide have nothing to worry about.
Ha!
Quote, all of our actions begin with some kind of lead based on information given to us by third parties, who usually fall into the category of disgruntled current or former employees, says Bob Kruger, Vice President of Enforcement for BSA.
Isn't that the same argument that led to the idea of, you know, nationwide identity cards? Those who
Bingo.
Have nothing to hide. Yeah, shouldn't be threatened by
it. I think that's the argument used for, like,
everything.
Every loss of privacy ever, you know, ever inflicted on every society since the birthplace, birth time of mankind. Quote, but just because you're disgruntled doesn't mean you don't know what you're talking about. People come to us with very detailed information that they gather through their access to company systems. The BSA doesn't launch frivolous investigations, of course. When a lead comes in, the organization compares it with information from software publishers and credit rating corporations like Dun & Bradstreet. But when the BSA finds employees with credible knowledge of software wrongdoing in their companies and the motivation to share what they know, it is righteously ready to use that information. Quote, who knows more about a company than someone who used to work there? Asked Kruger rhetorically. Quote, the ones with credible information are the ones we investigate. We ask them how they know the company's using illegal software, what products are involved, how many copies, who knows about it at the company. Once we get the information we need, we can start to investigate. Once the BSA is on the case, it's too late for a company to hope just to pay the unpaid software licensing fees. Nope. When the organization's been called out, it's pretty certain that the target company will end up paying a fair amount in addition to those fees.
Define fair.
If that is, it wants to avoid being sued under the copyright statutes found in Title 17 of the U.S. Code. The process often starts with BSA-affiliated attorneys who send warning letters to companies believed to have pirated software. The letters invite the company to do its own audit and report its finding to the BSA. If the company can provide it paid for all installed software, the matter ends there. But if not, all licenses were bought and paid for by the date the BSA first contacted the company. That spells trouble. The BSA asks offending companies to pay software licensing fees, which are passed along to the software developers, and then names a settlement figure. Quote, most companies come back with a different settlement number and we negotiate, says Jenny Blank, the BSA's director of enforcement. Quote, I'm not going to say they're cheerful about it, but they recognize that this is probably easier and less expensive than taking the case to court. If the company refuses to settle or if the BSA feels the company is criminally negligent and deliberately ripping off the software, the organization may decide to get a little nastier and organize a raid. The BSA makes its case in front of a federal court in the company's district and applies for a court order. If the order is granted, the BSA can legally storm the company's offices, accompanied by U.S. Marshals, to search for unregistered software. The BSA says most cases are settled cooperatively, but it performs at least a few raids every year.
The thing that's really bothering me about this story as we're going through it here is that here you have this organization which is akin to the Gestapo, mm-hmm. and it has an acronym that stands for it that is the same acronym used for the Boy Scouts. What is wrong with this picture?
On your honor.
Someone has to stand up for Microsoft's rights.
Can't Bill hire enough lawyers of his own?
I'm thinking they could consolidate and become the ATFS.
Oh, jeepers.
Alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and software.
Okay. Now the thing that really bothers me, though, about this one is you listen to the methods that they're describing, that they're using, mm-hmm. and I ask you, does this not fit the legal definition of blackmail?
Is it that, or is it the legal definition of harassment? I don't know.
Well, would it be blackmail on the part of the disgruntled employee?
Well, it could be if they went to their boss and threatened.
Mm. Yes,
but they probably haven't. They probably just want straight, clean revenge. Mm. So I would imagine that, yeah, I mean, it would be more possibly blackmail on their part because they name a figure, you name a figure, and if they don't like the figure that you name, then you're going to court. But I don't know. It's perfectly legal blackmail,
yeah,
really.
You double my. I'll tell you what. You double my severance pay, or I'm calling the BSA, and I'm going to tell them about that copy of Microsoft Windows that's running on that obscure box in the back corner of the computer lab that nobody ever touches because everybody forgets it's even there.
And how about those copies of Snood I see all around the office?
but
Snood is freeware.
Oh.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's also possible that the letter campaigns that they send out could constitute harassment before they have any proof, too.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It's scary
it's
stuff.
Threatening letters,
it really is. If you have a thought about this, we'd love to hear from you. 518-276-6248 will put you on the air. Let's see here. We have another one here that's kind of interesting. There's yet another Microsoft Outlook exploit on the loose, and this time the arrogance of the recommended solution is absolutely breathtaking. The problem is the built-in support for UU-encoded text within the body of a message. Prudent programmers will usually look for a starting string consisting of a blank line, the word begin on the starting of the next line, a three-digit octal number, and some sort of a file name followed by a carriage return, and subsequently verify that each line has the expected format. Even checking only the first few lines, for example, verifying that the first character correctly encodes the length of the rest of the lines, essentially eliminates any chance of a false hit. Sadly, it will surprise few people that Microsoft cuts straight to the heart of the matter. If your line starts with begin, possibly with two spaces afterwards, Outlook and Outlook Express will interpret the rest of the message as a UU-encoded attachment. It doesn't need a preceding blank line nor a following octal number. It doesn't need the subsequent lines that actually look like UU-encoded data. There are some reports on Slashdot that later versions of Outlook and Outlook Express have discarded the view source command, with which the effect of which is that the rest of the message is permanently lost to the user. The use of this bug as a denial-of-service attack on mailing lists that use a digest approach is left as an exercise for the listener. Naturally, it hasn't taken long for the malware writers to jump on the bandwagon. All you need to do to get around the strip-executable attachment killjoys is to put the malware right in the body of the message. Just start with a line that says, begin 666 www.myparty.yahoo.com, and you're off and running. Microsoft's official position is stunning in its feeble-mindedness and simplicity. We, and by we I mean every person on the planet who may ever send a message to an Outlook or Outlook Express victim user, or have a message forwarded to such users, are advised with editorial comments to, first off, not start messages with the word begin.
Never begin with begin.
Actually,
don't begin at the beginning.
It's any line starting with the word begin. And that's effectively a ban on the word begin for anybody using a mail agent with transparent line wrapping.
This
for example,
reminds me of that over 180-hour thing.
Yeah. For example, we will begin the new project when Bob returns from his vacation. Wait a minute. I skipped a line there. The webmail portals that some internet service providers are running might do this. Capitalize the word begin when using it within a sentence. Example, we will begin the new project when Bob returns from vacation with a capital B on the begin.
Yes, that way, if you can appear to be completely, grammatically dense to all of your fellow email people until they ask you why on earth you capitalize that, and then you can appear to be tech savvy, but for the most part, you just look like you don't know how to utilize the English language in
well,
its written
form. Well, I'll tell you what another...
Maybe they'll think you're German, you know, you just randomly capitalize words.
No, it's not random, though. It's not a noun, so you shouldn't be capitalizing
it. That's true. It's been a while since I've been in German class.
The thing I'm getting at, though, is... what you could do is if somebody wonders why you capitalize the word begin every time you see it, you tell them it's a holy word and you always capitalize holy words.
In the beginning.
Yes, exactly.
You could put like an underscore in front of the B, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Yep. Again, that'll make you look like you don't know how to type, but hey.
Use a different word. Use a different word such as start or commence. For example, all training materials to Visual Basic programs shall henceforth refer to start end loops instead of begin end loops. Microsoft's just...
They're renaming things now. We are going to rename all sorts of things just to keep Microsoft happy.
Yeah, Microsoft has announced that they're changing the English language.
Well, maybe you could get
The feminists didn't get away with it. Why do they think they will?
Maybe you could check... Microsoft Word spell checker or SG for some suitable synonyms.
We got to do a station ID. You're okay. Listening to WRPI, Troy.
There once was a station called WRPI, Troy.
There was a, now I've completely lost my train of thought. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but, you know.
You were saying that we're on WRPI in Troy?
Yes, I caught that part. Anyway, Microsoft's justification for suggesting a significant change to the English language instead of fixing their bug is given as, in an SMTP email message, file attachments that are encoded in UU-encoded format are defined when the word begin is followed by two spaces and then some data. Needless to say, there's no citation given for this fact. That's probably related to the fact that UU encode was defined by UUCP, not SMTP, and that every encoder decoder I have seen requires a leading blank line and an octal file permissions code. But the damage is done. Since the malware is exploiting this bug, we now get to put into place filters that don't just strip executable attachments or properly formatted UU encoded blocks. We also have to strip improperly formatted UU encoded blocks. Go figure. All right, we need to take a quick break here, and Little Brother will return in just a moment. And we're back, such as it is. Okay, let me see here. Well, let's see, I was just reading about that, so we'll toss that one aside. You got one you want to run with?
Yeah, here it says, woman says telephone makes unsolicited calls. That's interesting. This is yet another in the people treating caller ID when the information was never meant to be trusted series. As stated in the past issues, anyone with a PBX system can program their system to deliver any given name and phone number as the calling number ID information for any outgoing call from that system. In most businesses, this is used so that the outgoing calls appear to be from that company's main number for incoming calls rather than from the actual phone line used to place the call. A new trick many telemarketers are using to get around the new answering machines and phone company features that automatically shunt private and out-of-area calls to telemarketer blocking features is to select a name at random out of the phone book and use that name and phone number for their outgoing CNID information. I know I regularly receive telemarketing calls that show up on my CID box as being from some person purported to be in the 619 area code. This is no different from the way many spammers have recently taken to grabbing valid email address and using those as from addresses for their missives. I can't tell you the number of bounced email reports I get for an email address I stopped using some 2 or 3 years ago now, all with typical spam subject lines and originating from an open SMTP relay somewhere in the South Pacific. Alas, I don't believe misrepresentation of CNID information is any type of crime as stated before, it was never meant to be secure or any type of authenticated representation of who is actually calling. Risks. Believing that either CNID information or the from line on email actually represents the true originator of the call or message in question.
Hey, I got a question.
Yeah.
Where can you find an SMTP, like an open relay somewhere? Because most of them, you have to be logged into that ISP in order for your mail to get sent out.
I think you'd have to kind of war dial. You know, just start poking around on the internet looking for one.
If any callers have an answer to this question,
I can give you a hint.
What's that?
Like, co-location's a good.
Is it?
Yeah. It's a good place because I have to well, not me personally, but. Find,
of
like,
course, not you personally.
We find co-location customers are getting, you know, we whack them on the knuckles when that happens pretty often.
Now you were back to this other topic about call name ID.
Mm-hmm.
You were telling me a couple of weeks ago that a different radio show, a commercial radio show, which will remain unnamed, but we will say it originates out of Pahrump, Nevada,
and not the one that carries your show.
And not the one that carries this show, no. received a phone call from Kevin Mitnick and freaked him out by messing with the call ID information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know how it was done, or at least have something of an idea. You got one lined up there?
Yeah, file under, Fong's considering emigration. Australia's competition watchdog will intervene in a federal court case to defend PlayStation owners' right to modify their consoles to play imported games. Sony has launched legal action to try to prevent a business installing mod chips in PlayStation consoles. Mod chips override the regional playback controls in PlayStation consoles that ensure only games purchased in the appropriate country can be played. Without the devices, PlayStation consoles won't play pirated games or games brought overseas or on the internet. In the case, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission will argue that PlayStation manufacturer Sony's regional playback controls are unlawful. Professor Alan Fell said the ACCC would act as a, quote, friend of the court in the Sony copyright case. Quote, Sony is trying to stop these mod chips from being sold or installed in Australia, Professor Fels told a news conference in Melbourne today. Professor Fels said mod chips were not illegal, nor was purchasing PlayStation games overseas or over the internet. Quote, Australian moms and dads and children legitimately own these products, but Sony is trying to block their consumer rights, he said. Professor Fels said consumers were best served by access to the widest possible range of goods at the most competitive prices. He said Sony sold its games at different prices in each of its three marketing regions, North America, Asia, and Europe, which includes Australia. The company also limited the number of games sold in Australia, he said. Quote, we have these multinational companies continually arguing about the great benefits of globalization, but here they are trying to deny Australians the benefits of globalization. Professor Fels said PlayStation games that retail in Australia for $80 to $120 can be purchased over the internet for about $60, that is.
Yeah, that was very disturbing. Mm. I mean, you start your quotes, but you don't end them.
Oh, huh?
He always says, quote, yada, 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 yakety, schmackety. She said,
I don't know if
and
I,
it never end quote.
I don't know if I invented it, but...
Everything is always
I
in
always
quotation
follow
marks.
That as a radio convention, and, like, I thought my intonation kind of implied when it was done.
Actually, usually what implies when it's done, from what I'm hearing, is where it says, so-and-so said.
I don't know, I thought...
That sort of implies the end quote.
For the radio, it's kind of cumbersome to do the end quote. I don't know.
I haven't been doing quotes at all, so nobody knows what the hell's going on when I read a story, so who knows?
Well, perhaps I should just do it in, like different voices, like, you know, Professor Fell said, Sony is trying to stop his magic from being sold and installed in Australia. I don't like spam.
You know, yeah, I mean, we've got some practice. I mean, Phil has a daughter at home. We could do that. We could do different
voices. Why don't
we
do each of these articles as a radio play? We could each
Yeah, we should. You can email me the stories, and what I'll do is I'll type them up as a radio play.
With sound
effects. With sound effects.
Especially when the BSA is doing raids.
Boing. In the old days of radio, you know, when they used to have...
Don't move!
They used to have those whole shows with... it was like you're telling a story over the radio.
Yeah,
and
radio
the
place.
Just brought it alive.
Yeah, it was,
radio place.
That's where the soap opera originated.
Or how about...
Not that that's any value, but that's where that started.
I've got an idea. Why don't we post the stories ahead of time on the website, and then we can make that little ching-a-ding chime sound from the read-along, like, record storybook sets so that, like, when listeners are listening, they know what to change the page.
When you hear this sound, turn the page.
Yeah. Or turn the slide. Remember those slideshows when we were kids in school?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, those are great.
So anyway, back on track here.
And by great, I mean they suck.
Is that possible?
My comment on this Sony case, well, I don't know. I'm starting to like Australia more and more as the, you know, they seem to be protecting the rights of just what's, you know, just and good for the individual and the consumer. And it sounds like in that regard, it's kind of a neat place to live. I think one thing that came to mind when I was reading this story is that companies, especially like console manufacturers, they kind of, I think Sony is kind of playing, you know, they're trying to get their cake and eat it too by, they chose to use a standard format, a CD.
Well, sure.
For the transport of their media.
Because it's cheap.
Yeah. So I don't think that they should legally, I don't think that they justly have the right to enforce all sorts of, you know, control mechanisms.
Okay, we have a call on the line. Let's see who's here. Hello, caller. Are you there? Hello, caller, you're on the air. Okay, I guess they're not there. And that's okay. If you do feel so inclined that you don't want to put your voice on the air, please feel free to drop me an email, critter@verizoneatspoop.com, and I'll be happy to read your email over the air if you just tell me that you want me to, you know?
In a funny voice.
I'll hand it to you, and you can read it over the air. But going back to the topic of Australia here, absolutely. If memory serves, they're also the same country that has pretty much outlawed DVD region coding.
Yeah.
And for those in the listening audience who are not familiar with DVD region coding, if you buy a DVD in the U.S., it's region coded region 1. If you take this DVD over to Europe, where region code 2, and you try to play it, your DVD player that you bought and paid for will refuse to play the DVD that you bought and paid for. And it's not like it's incompatible. It is a flat-out refusal.
Mm.
It's perfectly capable. It just refuses.
I have a question. I was playing with the DVD settings in Windows XP.
Yeah.
And you can change the regional code, but it limits you to only changing it a couple times.
Absolutely. And
it says even if you reinstall Windows or move the DVD drive to another computer, you still can't change it.
That is correct.
They put a flash right in the drive?
Right in the drive. It's a requirement.
Wow.
That's how region coding is implemented. And if you have a hardware DVD player, the same is true. You can only change it 2, maybe 3 times.
So I can change it to the European standard, but then I can only play European
DVDs
on there. Wow. Well, you could have a couple DVD drives in your computer and have one set to play European content.
What do you guys think of the concept that I was starting to touch on? Is that I think, just out of principle, if a company's going to use, I guess DVDs don't apply to this because the standard included region encoding. But like, let's say PlayStation is using CD-ROMs as their media. If they're, you know, gaining the benefits of using a standard format like a CD, you know, such as it's inexpensive to produce because it's so widely used and distributed. And the machinery to print those are going to be much less expensive than it would be to manufacture a proprietary format like a Nintendo cartridge.
Like a cartridge, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so I think the main reason that they are particular about what region you're playing stuff in, like with the DVDs, like, for example, a lot of Japanese stuff, you're not supposed to be able to use over here in America because they have much looser laws about what can be in things.
But, you know, the funny thing
like,
of it is...
It's a tried and true... I mean, it's like a classic thing, you know, getting video games, different versions from Japan. There's like a lot more nudity maybe or
something
like that.
But I have a fundamental problem with that. Let me describe what the problem is. Mm-hmm. We have this principle in theory in this country called freedom of speech. We also have this principle in theory called freedom of choice. If you want to make the material, you should be able to make the material. And if you want to look at the material, you should be able to buy the material. If you don't want to look at the material, don't buy it.
Right, but at the same time, we have a thing where parents want their children to be protected from seeing lewd material without having to actually, you know, protect them themselves. So we have laws where things like, you know, you have to be over 18 to get this or that or the other thing, and that's the problem.
Okay, this is going to resonate with you, I think.
This is where it comes from.
The U.S. government has therefore become an enabler.
Yeah, it has. It's become the enabler of, you know, everyone's dysfunctional parenting style in America.
Bingo.
I went to buy the nicotine patch today, and they ID'd me.
You're kidding me.
No, it was funny.
It was funny, too, because I was actually there to buy my prescription, and he happened to pick up the patch. And the guy asked me how old I was, and I was like, they never asked me that before. Are they suddenly carding for the birth control pill? I was not aware of these things, you know? I was like, what is this? But it was for the patch that he was asking him.
Okay.
But I was very confused at first.
But
I didn't realize
for the patch.
Up.
Now, I would have thought that a prescription would have been all that would have been necessary for the problem at hand.
Right. But, you know, the patch is no longer necessarily a prescription
Seeing as how...
But apparently they don't want people under the age of 18 to quit using the patch.
That's exactly where I was going.
So, I don't know.
Boy, yeah, that is exactly where I was going with that one. I actually stole that
from Phil. He said that before, you know.
Oh, okay, well, that's cool then.
Under the age of 18. Theoretically, I suppose, but I guess they just want them to suffer for the fact that they're underage smokers and quit cold turkey.
And did they have this over 18 policy posted, or was the sign spam blocked?
I don't know if there was a sign around it or anything, but what actually happened is he scans it in, and the computer prompts him to ask you how old you are at the pharmacy. But it does say on the packaging that you can't buy it if you're under 18.
That's really weird.
Really weird.
Because I would think, especially given the fact that it is illegal for those under 18 to smoke in the first place, that these are the first people you would want to help quit by letting them use the patch.
Well, theoretically, I guess so, but probably because it's something, you know, involving nicotine, there's probably some weird loophole in the law that, you know, when you're under 18, you can't get it. It's weird.
I don't know. Well, folks, an amazing thing has happened. We have actually gotten through all the material.
Which has never happened before.
Which has never happened
and,
before.
And with so many sidetracking, too. Did you get stuff off Less Digest
did you
this
not
week
get
or
through
something?
Oh, you,
oh, he still has some stories.
Fong's hoarding it.
I've been holding out.
All right.
Yeah, you didn't ask him. You just asked me.
I think we... Well, I just saw this pile of papers in front of him with the last story that was read sitting on top of it, and I assumed since he had
well,
to turn the page...
That's what you saw on my side, and you asked me if I had more to read.
But I assumed that since he hadn't turned the page, that there wasn't anything underneath it.
Yeah, I see. You're assuming that he's more, you know...
We can start reading things.
Competent
out
to be on the radio.
That's what it is. There's an article, Michael Jackson.
Can we just start making things up?
That.
You know, no. I mean, there's a lot of technology involved in Michael Jackson. There. I mean, look at that face. He was not born with that.
He was rendered.
He was rendered.
So that's what 3D rendering is.
Yes. Now you know. Now you know. There's a lot of technology involved in that picture, right?
Well,
there.
He invented morphing.
Yes, morphing. Yes.
That's true. That's true. I don't know if he actually... I doubt he actually invented the technology itself, but it was his idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He inspired it.
Damn him.
Can we jump ahead to the story that interests me here?
Yeah, we got time for one more, I think.
No, read all the stories that are boring first.
Does someone else want to read it with, like...
Can I read it with the funny
both
voices?
Beginning and ending quotes?
Okay, let's see here. Yeah, this one comes to us out of the L.A. Times. They said, as makers of personal video recorders broaden the appeal of their revolutionary devices, a group of Hollywood studios is attacking the recorder's core functions. PVRs are the digital successor to video cassette recorders, storing programs digitally on a high-capacity computer hard drive instead of removable tapes. They play tricks with live programs, pausing, rewinding, and replaying them in mid-broadcast, and making it simple to find and record shows that match one's tastes. Two of the leading PVR brands, TiVo and Replay TV, recently announced plans to deliver more types of entertainment through their devices, including digital music services and online video programming. Sonic Blue Incorporated, the Santa Clara-based firm behind Replay TV, plans to sell a version of its recorder this fall for less than other PVRs on the market. Sonic Blue is steaming ahead despite four lawsuits filed by Hollywood Studios just as the Replay TV 4000 was being introduced in November. The lawsuits, which were brought by the largest TV networks and all seven major Hollywood movie companies, say the Replay TV recorders violate copyrights by enabling users to send videos to other Replay TV boxes over the internet and skip commercials automatically.
Isn't this sound like a little bit of deja vu? Anybody who's been around, who was around in the 80s for an advent of the little thing, a little thing that we call the VCR?
Yes, this does sound very familiar.
I remember a little lawsuit against Sony, of all people, ironically, by some similar
Yes, because I guess they were concerned that being able to record a television program at home was equivalent to violating the copyright on that program, even though...
They're still concerned about that with TiVo or whatever, aren't they? They're still causing a ruckus with TiVo and some other things.
You were busy reading Vibe.
Is that what this is about?
That's
TiVo?
One of the stories.
That's what this is on, yeah.
Well, you said video cameras or whatever.
Replay TV, personal video recorders. Replay TV, though, their new...
Oh, personal video recorders is TiVo? Oh, God, I'm sorry.
Yeah, TiVo is... Well, no, personal video recorders aren't TiVos. TiVos are personal video recorders.
When you say personal video recorders, I'm picturing, like, a camcorder. Like, record... I thought you were talking about cameras, that's why. It's not that I wasn't listening, sort of. I was actually looking at the freakish dissimilarity between childhood pictures of Michael Jackson and the cover picture of how he looks currently. And it is very weird.
Well, but the thing of it is, the thing that's got their knickers in a knot this time is that the one of the new versions of the Replay TV has the ability to take the content that has been recorded on the hard drive and export it. You can send it out over the internet.
Dear God.
And what they're concerned about is that television's going to get Napsterized. Now it all makes sense.
To some extent, it already has, because there's, I mean, if you go on the internet, you could find episodes of The Simpsons, you could find episodes of
Invader Zim.
I can tell you of a better, you know, an even more striking case, which I personally participated in. On September 11th, I, you know, learned of what was happening on the radio driving to work. And in my office, we didn't have any sort of TV set up other than like a closed circuit television, which we later rigged. But throughout the morning, I relied on file sharing services because people were already capturing and posting AVIs.
Oh, yeah.
Within, you know, the first hour. And that was the way I, that was the my first means of
well, I'll tell you the thing that, seeing the thing that I found really interesting, I'm not a fan of Microsoft. Everybody here and everybody who's heard my show in the past and everybody who knows me personally knows this for a fact. But, using a media player, you can go to, you could go to a Microsoft site and hook up with a live stream of the BBC at 400 kbps, and it brought you a really good picture.
I did that.
You
too.
Did that, yeah.
But I think it would be grand. I mean, of course, I'm speaking as a consumer. I think it's a great thing to Napsterize television because, like, it's just like with music. Where else are you going to find the rare, weird stuff? Like, say you have a favorite sitcom or, for example, cartoon, such as Phil and I have, that, you know, has been canceled. There's a cartoon that was on Nickelodeon for a while called Invader Zim, which is hysterical, absolutely hysterical. And we now have every single episode, even though we don't have cable or anything. But it's on the computer. And if it weren't Napsterized, we never would have been able to get it because it's not on the air anymore.
Well, WRPI Troy.
I'm going to throw out one. Oh, go ahead, Fong.
Can I? I almost want to turn into like an armchair economist for a second and look at this at a really base level.
Move it quickly, though, because we're up against the clock, actually.
Station ID, so
no, but like. You know, I would offer to the major networks a suggestion that, you know, just get with it, get over it. The marketplace is changing and, you know, it comes down to, you know,
survival of the fittest.
If PVRs are outlawed, only outlaws will have PVRs.
Well, I'm going to have to throw one last comment out, and then we're going to have to
What's
jump
your comment,
out.
WRPI, Troy?
No, we'll do the station ID, the official station ID in just a minute. But what the thing of it is that... when you are when you're looking at the different PVRs out there, there's one that that particularly was very popular amongst amongst people who were interested in this kind of functionality. That would, of course, be the TiVo, and the reason is TiVo runs Linux. And a friend of mine has actually hacked his TiVo to add an Ethernet card to it, and he can stream the video out of it, and it's a beautiful thing.
That's awesome.
It's a beautiful thing. Well, we're up against the clock. We're going to have to wrap it up. And stay tuned. 7 o'clock tonight, the RPI engineers play Bowling Green. So stay tuned for that. This is Little Brother, and episode 35. And
WRPI Troy.
No. That's what I was going to ask. If the TiVo, does it have standard connectors in there? Does it have a PCI port, or what's in there?
I believe it was a PCI port, yeah.
Was it?
Or an ISA, maybe. I'll have to ask him. I'll tell you next week.
Yeah, if we can get hold of a TiVo, we can play around with it. That'd be cool.
All right. Gotta run. Catch you next week.